We've all dealt with the checkbox on forms, the one that asks our sex. For a long time, the only two choices were M or F. These days, there's also occasionally an X, which is a kind of catch-all meant to include trans, non-binary, and intersex identities, among others. Have you ever stopped to ask, why is this something we need to declare in the first place? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Gender identities may always have existed among human populations, but when governments and other institutions started making them official, keeping permanent records of a determination made about us at birth, they became something else entirely. Paisley Kura is professor of political science and women's and gender studies at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the co-editor of Transgender Rights and co-founding editor of TSQ, Transgender Studies Quarterly. His book is called Sex Is as Sex Does, Governing Transgender Identity. He joined us in August, and today we're listening back to that conversation. Paisley, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think many of us whose sex and gender identities have always matched the ones assigned to us at birth find it maybe easy to overlook the most basic question of all, which is, why is this information collected by the folks who give you a driver's license or a passport or a mortgage?
Right. I mean, that's a really important question. And a lot of transgender people kind of come up against the fact of a sex classification system and think that in some senses it's transphobic and it certainly has those effects. But it actually goes way back to like making distinctions between men and women because men and women didn't have the same rights. So the reason that sex classification systems are baked into our laws and government is because of the different sex-based rights that men used to have.
How explicitly did the earliest iterations of the Constitution spell out different rights for people determined to be women or men?
Sadly, I'm laughing. Well, the Constitution, the Constitution doesn't really have a place for women's rights. It doesn't mention gender. It assumes sort of a universal human being that is the textualists assume is men. So when with the Justice Alito's opinion, the Dobbs draft, he says he's kind of citing a document that had no at the time of its writing had no sense of women's equality. So it's just absent from the Constitution.
So this stuff can get pretty bizarre. You discovered you could change the sex designation on your New York State driver's license, but only if you had an official letter from your doctor. What was your doctor supposed to attest to?
So the doctor, so every state, every agency in a state and every federal agency, they have rules for changing your sex classification. And every agency has like the rules written down differently. Some don't allow you to, some require different things. So at the time I changed my sex designation in New York State, it was like the early 2000s. I think the policy was you had to submit a doctor's letter, saying that your gender identity was either male or female, and it was set in place, and the policy even back then it was relatively liberal. As it didn't say you had to have any kind of surgery, but it did say you had to have a letter from a doctor. And so when I wanted to change mine, I'm an academic and I'm pretty good at filling out forms, and I had all my forms and affidavits and a doctor's letter. Even when I went in and talked to the clerk at the DMV, they were like, oh, this is a letter from a surgeon, but the policy says you're supposed to have a letter from a doctor.
Oh,
and it's kind of like, it took like three levels of supervision for them to agree that my surgeon's letter would count. But it wasn't about transphobia. It was just about like, oh my gosh, what do we do? I'm confused. I forget everything. I'm dealing with this transgender person. I don't know anything about who a doctor is or who a surgeon is. So it was a certain kind of like transgender confusion that I kind of my presence elicited, but it wasn't necessarily transphobic. It got worked out eventually.
And of course, gender affirming surgery is not something every trans person wants or has access to, even if they do want it, right? So aside from any health problems that may prevent that surgery, we've created a kind of socioeconomic requirement for this.
Yes, that's really a good observation. So it used to be a lot of identity document policies required some sort of surgery, but surgery wasn't covered by the private insurers. It wasn't covered by most Medicaid plans. And so people were not able to get those surgeries. A lot of people didn't want them. Some people couldn't have them. But it turned like whether or not you could change your documents into a matter of how much money you had or how much debt you're willing to take on to get those documents. And there's, it's very weird kind of construction of identity where like people who have more access to resources get to have the gender classification fixed, and those who don't were not able to.
And it gets more bizarre from there. You also have learned that different state and local and federal agencies have different policies around this sort of thing. So depending on where in the U.S. you live, how might official documents for one person contradict one another?
Yeah, absolutely. So every agency has its own rules, and they have their own rules because they just deciding whether someone is male or female is what they call in administrative law a matter of housekeeping. It's like deciding, you know, how wide a road is or something. So every agency would make up its own rules, and those rules would be would differ. So the DMV has different rules than birth certificates, and jurisdictions might have different policies and rules. And so it puts transgender people in this kind of Kafka-esque kind of situation of not knowing what the rules are and what stuff you're supposed to have done. And one 2015 survey found that like 68% of trans people hadn't been able to change any of their IDs. And only 11% of people were able to change all of their identity documents. So it's a real big gap in terms of what people want and what they're getting.
And these laws and policies, intentionally or not, can set certain people up to be perceived as breaking the law simply by claiming their own identity. Can you tell us what happened to Jane Jones in Idaho in 1994? I don't know, by the way, if that's her real name, but she's called Jane Jones.
It's a public document, but I put a pseudonym in there because, you know, who wants to have their name in a book like that? So, the police went to her house. A local sheriff went to her house because her husband had been writing bad checks. So they kind of went to the house and they went through everybody's documents and they realized that she was a trans woman. And then they decided that since she was married to a man, a cisgender man, that marriage was illegal in Idaho. So she was actually arrested on the spot for false personation. So that's like an extreme, very literal example of transgender people breaking the law. But it's in exactly the situation that a lot of transgender people find ourselves in terms of not having the right identity documents. One trans woman who was testifying before a New York City committee a long time ago, maybe 20 years ago, she said, "You know what? I don't have gender dysphoria. My problem is bureaucratic dysphoria. My ID doesn't match my appearance."
As our culture, Paisley, begins to grapple with the notion that there are more than two possible identities around sex and gender, is it reasonable to start thinking about these categories as cultural constructs comparable to the socially constructed categories of race that we now understand to exist?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that like government decisions about sex classification are about like power and politics and sometimes policy. And we understand that to be true in terms of like the legal construction of racial categories in terms of like what's in the interest, you know, going back in history of the colonizing population, what's in the interest of the slave owning population. So these rules about sex are effects of power, not so much about what sex really is.
This might be a place in the conversation where some people would want a definition of exactly whom the word transgender applies to. You remind us in the book, though, that some scholars think the term maybe is better left kind of loosely defined.
Yeah, like everybody has a desire to have kind of neat and clean definitions. And so transgender, like the most useful definition is to say someone who's moved away from the sex they were assigned at birth, and moved away might be transitioning into another gender or not meeting the gender norms for their assigned sex at birth or being non-binary. But the one thing that's good about the word transgender is that's a word that emerged from trans people ourselves. So unlike transsexual, which is a word that was developed by the medical profession, transgender is a word that comes from the community. So it's always dangerous when a word kind of gets locked up and defined and domesticated, and then it becomes a criteria that has to be met. So the trans communities are very much about keeping things open and not putting up boundaries.
Even like the distinction between sex and gender can get problematic if we're not really careful, right?
Right. Well, I mean, people spend a lot of time talking about like what's gender, what's sex, what's the relationship between them. And as someone who's been doing gender and sexuality studies for my entire career. I'm super interested in that too. But then for this book, I thought everybody's always talking about like, what is sex? How should we define it? As like, what if we just look at how governments define it and then kind of reverse engineer that? So decide that like sex is whatever the government says it is, and then look into why do they say someone is F for the purposes of marriage, but M for the purposes of their identity documents? Like, how can we come to understand that what looks like a contradiction?
Meanwhile, our ideas of what male and female mean have so often been positioned as opposite to one another, which puts them into a frame that, you know, once you start thinking about it, is not all that helpful. We all know males and females are not opposite things.
Right. The discourse is very much around like, the traditional discourse is very much around like men and women are opposite. And transgender people kind of, the existence of transgender people can kind of upset that thinking, even though there are many transgender people who are what we would call binary, who see themselves as one gender or the other. But the existence of people who transition or move away the gender kind of suggests that like these kind of firm categories, oppositional categories, aren't exactly right. But with transgender people, for example, in sports, it sort of challenges the ideas, not just that men and women are different, but a lot of the ideology is that men are naturally better. And women are naturally worse. And so we need to protect the women from the men.
Do you have any hope that the day will come when our assumptions around gender have loosened to the extent that not as many people feel as if they have to involve the government and change their documents because they're just free to be themselves and not make a declaration?
Yeah, I think that is a long-term goal or the medium-term goal of many people in the trans rights movement is like, why do we need to track people's gender? And actually, once the Supreme Court ruled in 2015 that same-sex marriage was, or bans on same-sex marriage were unconstitutional, that actually really was probably the biggest policy change that mattered to transgender people, even though it seems to be a case about same-sex marriage. It actually was one of the last kind of major ways that the government is involved in keeping track of people's sexes, because they have to classify people's sex if they're going to make sure that gay people can't get married. So I think that kind of moved us into a land or an era where perhaps, you know, gender designation, it shouldn't matter. But as we can discuss, it still does matter culturally.
And do you have concerns about the Obergefell decision moving forward based on what the Supreme Court and specifically Justice Thomas has said recently?
Yes. I have concerns because, you know, Justice Thomas is turning out to be sort of one of the anchors of this contemporary court. And actually I have a colleague at CUNY, Corey Robin, who wrote a whole, you know, book, intellectual biography of Justice Thomas's thinking. And, you know, he didn't speak much for much of his time on the bench, but he is turning out to be one of the kind of key players in the kind of conservative revolution. And he said in his concurrence in the Dobbs opinion that, right, we need to get rid of Roe versus Wade. We also need to reconsider Lawrence versus Texas, which is that's where the Supreme Court said you can't throw people in jail for having consensual same-sex sex. And we also have to reconsider Obergefell and also contraception decisions. So we're at a very scary precipice, I think.
Okay, Paisley, your primary argument here is that governments actually decide what sex we are in a surprising number of situations. What forms do those declarations take in U.S. society that we might not even think about?
Sure. I don't think you would think about it unless most people don't think about it unless they're like transgender and navigating this themselves. So so it's a matter of like saying what sex you are on college applications, driver's licenses, marriage licenses, like almost any time you do things, you have to kind of say your sex. So the Transportation Security Administration would ask people their gender before they fly. I think the Biden administration is going to get rid of that question, but that is an example that causes trans people problems because you have to answer that question. You have to provide identity that matches that. And then you walk through this weird machine that looks at what your body looks like. So there's just so many different places where one's sex classification is being scrutinized.
And it's been so common for so many of us for all of our lives that it becomes almost invisible until folks come up against some sort of conflict. The first time someone pointed this out to me, I thought, well, you know, maybe identification documents, you need this. And then I thought, well, there's a photograph on all these documents. So that should tell somebody if the person standing before them is the person they're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, yeah, you think a relatively recent photograph would be enough identity information to provide the government. But in fact, people expect there to be sex on their documents. And sex is really, it's one of the first what we call biometric identifiers. It's very crude. It's like something about the person's birth sex we know. Now we have biometric identifiers in our fingerprints, facial recognition, eye scans. We have so much more kind of sophisticated biometric identifiers, but sex is lets people kind of say, well, we can take this person out of 50% of the possible people in the population if we know what sex they are. So that's it's been a tool of government for surveillance for a long time.
And do those assumptions also create an implicit rule that people are supposed to behave or perform the sort of gender norms that are associated with that sex?
Well, traditionally, there has been a history in the United States of laws against what we call, you know, what was called cross-dressing. So, you know, people would have to wear a certain number of articles of clothing associated with the sex they're assigned at birth. And so those laws, you know, have, you know, obviously fallen by the wayside the last 50, 60 years. Though we see in some of the kind of recent right-wing moves against gender nonconforming kids that expressions of gender nonconformity is something that teachers are being expected to kind of track and report on. I think that's one of the policies in, say, for example, the Florida schools.
So the reason governments claim this right is so that they can, historically, so that they could decide which rights and responsibility belong to which people. How many sort of gender separate cases remain for rights or responsibilities according to sex?
There's very few. There is registering for the draft, Selective Service. I'm trying to think of others. There's very few. I think almost everything in the armed forces has been open to women. There might be a couple of small areas, but it's just mostly the registration for the Selective Service that is left. But over the course of the 20th century, like most of the ways the government distinguished between men and women, you know, were ended, which is a good thing. But culturally, there's still this expectation that the government can tell you what your sex is.
What are the policies surrounding registering for Selective Service now for trans folks?
The policies, I just looked at that recently. The policies are trans men, they don't care about, you know. And trans women have to still register. They still have to do something, like do what cisgender men have to do. So it's they're going kind of by assigned sex at birth, basically, still.
If the political will existed to enact such a policy, do you have any confidence that it would be better for folks with identities that don't conform to, as you say, the external genitalia observed at birth? Would it be better if we didn't have any of these?
Yeah, I think we don't have any real need to tell people what gender they are or to track people's gender. So I think that would be a positive policy direction. In New York City, what's really interesting is the city has come a long way. And when birth certificates to change your birth certificate in New York City, you could just go into the office or maybe fill out a form online and say, I am male, I am female, I am non-binary. So you have to have one of those categories, but you could even choose non-binary, which is good. So that's like a move in the right direction. But what's super interesting to me is that babies that are born in New York City hospitals are assigned a sex by the doctor, so male or female. And then later, if those people who turn out to be adults want to change their sex classification, they can, or as children with the supports of their parents, they can. But it shows to me the kind of bifurcated system we have where, like, the Democratic mayor of New York City said, okay, trans community, here's the policy you want. You can change your documents. But for every other baby being born, it still kind of puts them in this sex classification system.
Is it possible in New York City, where that sort of third category exists, for parents to request an X for their children at birth?
I think you can't do it at birth. I think you have to do some paperwork after. But some states, California and two others let parents request an exit birth. So it's all over the place right now, but there are some states where parents can request that.
You note that the issue of sex reclassification might appear to be relevant, really mostly only to trans folks and those who love them. Who else might actually have an interest in changing or minimizing the significance of sex classifications?
Well, I think I think there's two different strands of that question. When the government was interested in making sure men got more stuff than women, that was a reason to kind of maintain them. And as we stop doing that, there's less reason to maintain them. But now we're in this new moment of this kind of gender convulsions where like sex and the distinctions between men and women are sort of being relitigated, you know, by the right wing in terms of these laws and policies that are passing. I think the state of Oklahoma just said this year they passed a law saying no non-binary ever. We're not going to have non-binary birth certificates. They just kind of stepped in. And so where before this had been the kind of purview of kind of behind the scenes policymakers and bureaucrats who are sometimes guided by, you know, medical opinion, now it's been politicized. And that's a very bad moment for us.
How historically was sex assigned to people born intersex?
Well, there's lots of different criteria that would be used. Sometimes they would run genetic tests to see to look at the chromosomes, visual inspection of the external genitalia, and inspection of the kind of reproductive system. And one of the things that's interesting about the intersex situation is that it was considered for a long time to be like a medical emergency when an intersex person was born. And most of the time it was like not a medical emergency at all. But the way the endocrinologists were brought in and the geneticists were brought in, the surgeons were brought in, is like it was a problem to be solved as soon as possible because we couldn't have these parents go home from the hospital without knowing what gender their child is. And then the last, 20, 30 years, that those policies have changed a lot because of the work of intersex activists.
So I do think a lot of people who are supportive of the rights of trans and non-binary people would assume that the ongoing expectation that everybody should be able to be described with either an M or an F on official documents, everybody saying that is fueled by simple transphobia. Why do you think this explanation actually doesn't entirely cover what we're dealing with here?
Right. I think transphobia is a perfectly good description of the effects some of these policies have, but it's kind of like saying the weather is hot. Like that can be helpful, but it doesn't tell us why it's hot. So transphobia doesn't provide an explanation of like why we have these policies. They may have bad effects on trans people, but sometimes the effects on trans people were unimagined or accidental. More recently, with some of this right-wing legislation, it's very much intentional, but I'm trying to understand like how sex works in terms of governments and states at a kind of deeper level to see like, oh, DMVs do something different than marriage does. So that's why we have different policies. We've had different policies on sex classification in different areas of the law.
Is there any consistency at the federal level?
Well, the consistency at the federal level, it's interesting. At the state level, it's sort of it can be by agency, but it's also geographic, spatial. At the federal level, it's about the administration, so it's about time. So the Obama administration obviously was stymied in Congress, but they did so much for LGBTQ people on the level of administrative law and changing rules and policies. Then Trump comes in and he reverses as much as he can in 4 years. And then Biden comes in and he's, you know, he tries to reverse as much as he can. And obviously the courts are involved. So there is more likely to be consistency, some consistency at the federal level, but it changes based on who's running the federal government.
What does it feel like to be living as a trans person in a country where the lines drawn around who you are, what you can do, who you can call yourself continue to change?
Yeah, it's really shocking because I think like many of us, even though I think I'm a sophisticated academic, I'm just like everyone else in the sense of like, I believe that things should get better. Like as time progresses, things get better. And we see right now that things are not getting better. Like in Florida, what's happening with Governor DeSantis is he's having the Medicaid rules rewritten so the state will not provide gender-affirming care for trans people. trans children and trans adults, and that's like a very frightening moment that for people in Florida, and for that being kind of like a precursor to a larger Republican assault on, you know, gender affirming care for transgender people. So it's like a very, I'm just surprised at how we've reached this very frightening moment in 2022.
It has been interesting, Paisley, to see how many people, particularly families of trans kids, are voting with their feet. They're moving out of states where they feel like policies are not good for their loved ones.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a very recent but very sad phenomenon with these anti-trans policies. There's the sports bills, but if your kid can't play sports, that's not great. But these attacks on gender-affirming care for trans youth is really terrible. And like in Arkansas, in Alabama, and other places. And so if your kid is, you know, is getting gender-affirming care, if your teenager is become like, you know, been treated and, you know, has their suffering has been alleviated, and suddenly that's going to be cut off, or you're going to be investigated for child abuse for supporting your child, of course people are going to want to move. Unfortunately, the people who, not everybody have the resources to move or can just pick up and move to a different state.
I don't want to digress too much here because we could spend the rest of the hour talking about this. But on the question of sports competitions, have you seen anything proposed that would satisfy everyone or most people who are arguing over this question now of how to slot people into categories that have always been assumed to appropriately be divided between males and females?
Yeah, I mean, so the International Olympic Committee released a framework last November that said, here's what we should think about. We should think about fairness, inclusion, non-discrimination, protecting the integrity of women's sports, and having a policy that's data-driven. The problem with some of the sports policies is that they're not about the data, but they're about like what people think of men and women. And so the important data point is like, how do transgender women compare to cisgender women? Like, how many months of hormone blockers do they need to be on? How many years of estrogen do they need to be on? That's the important data point, and there needs to be more study on that. And then the problem is all the bad policies come from people comparing men, cisgender men, to cisgender women and how they do. And then it's gotten politicized with legislatures passing laws that saying like kids in school can't play on teams. So in Utah, it's a really interesting story. Utah passed legislation this March, making sure that that said trans girls can't play on girls' teams. And the governor of Utah, a Republican, he vetoed the legislation. And in his veto statement, he noted there are 75,000 high school kids who play sports in Utah. There are 4 transgender kids and 1 trans girl playing sports in Utah, and no question or no fuss have been raised about any of them. And he said, rarely has so much fear and anger been directed at so few. So he vetoed that legislation, and then they came back and overrode the veto. So it doesn't really make any sense, because the level of competitive elite sports, the sports federations are working on their policies and figuring it out. For legislators to come in and say, this kid can't play intramural volleyball because of what we think about gender, is just really absurd.
So it just turns into kind of a slippery slope argument for many people.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
How do sex classifications tend to work in concert with racial and economic inequality to magnify disadvantage for certain people?
Right. So one of the things that happens with transgender people is that people who kind of suffer from what we might call live in these intersectional spots of vulnerability. So based on race or ethnicity, and gender, are much more likely to not get the services they need. So, for example, if we look at incarceration, which we know is very highly racialized, and people of color are much more likely to be incarcerated than white people, that's also amplified by someone's experience of being transgender. So there's more transgender people in prison than would be indicated by the population, but especially more transgender people of color and transgender women of color. So it just gets amplified.
Paisley, what role has the feminist movement played in, as you say, lowering the stakes for sex reclassification?
Yeah, the feminist movement has played a really important role, and I think in some senses that has been lost and not been acknowledged by trans rights advocates over the years, because we operate in this world of identity politics. We say there's a transgender people and there's a transgender rights movement, and we've made a lot of progress, and that's certainly true to some extent. But in fact, a lot of the progress we've made comes as a result of what people call second wave feminism, or getting the government out of the business of treating men differently than women. So a lot of the gains of second wave feminism, which ultimately involved stopping making distinctions between men and women, had a really positive effect on transgender people.
But some of the resistance to reforming sex classification policies, you think may be an outgrowth of anxiety over the ways feminism has changed the culture.
I do think we're in some strange moment of gender convulsion, and like the right wing's long-term, decades-long project of reversing Roe versus Wade has, met up with its relatively shorter attention span on transgender rights and trying to attack transgender people. And so I think it really is a little bit about nervousness about who what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman. And so, for example, the abortion decision, the Dobbs decision, kind of puts women and pregnant people back in this second class position of like not being able to kind of live their lives the way people who can't get pregnant can live their lives. And the right wing attack on transgender people is also about maintaining that gender binary, and not allowing people to kind of change their gender across those lines.
What is the advantage to people who don't want others to change their gender identity or to sort of disobey the rules of gender in this culture?
Well, I think it's about certainty, and it's about like we know what people are, or their birth sex determines who they are. But I think it's also, you can't look at gender without looking at hierarchy. It's also about maintaining a hierarchy. Like, not only that men and women are different, and those are natural qualities, but that men are better. Because if you start scratching a little bit deeper into right-wing discourse around gender, they're not feminists. Like, with respect to sports, it's super ironic because they're talking about preserving the integrity of women's sports, which transgender rights advocates are also interested in. But it's not as if Republicans or the right wing were fans of Title IX, like getting rid of discrimination in education and sports in education. They've long been against Title IX. So there's just a lot of hypocrisy going on right now in some of the discourse.
I realize that trans folks may spend their entire lives in some ways pushing back against gender policing, but I wonder if our culture's gender biases harm those trans folks who can't, and please excuse the expression, easily pass as the gender that they identify as more than folks who do pass.
Yeah, absolutely. I think non-binary people or people who don't pass. I am a kind of binary transgender person. I'm not super muscular or masculine, but I have a beard and I'm balding, so that kind of makes me pass. And so I don't get my gender challenged. But people who don't pass or don't want to pass, and now we kind of use the word, I think we say blend in, are more likely to be challenged. And for example, with the bathroom bills that we saw a few years ago, and I think might be coming back, one study found that like the biggest group, the group that was most likely to be harassed in the bathrooms were gender non-conforming women. So when people who are assigned female at birth had a identified as women, but just were not particularly feminine, and they were the most likely to be challenged. So a lot of the gender policing really harms people who don't blend in, for sure.
So every legal system, maybe since the Hammurabi Code, is going to borrow from something that came before. Tell us a little bit about how American systems for creating laws around sex classification have taken cues from European laws that existed before them.
Well, it's a kind of interesting question because in the United States we just kind of incorporated a lot of the English common law, and English common law, had a lot to say about men and women and marriage and parenting, and so a lot of the transgender marriage cases kind of draw on the English common law tradition, in terms of like who can get married to who, and then who is classified as a father and who's not classified as a father. There's a super interesting kind of tradition in the common law, which is to say, like, if a man and a woman are married, it is, we're going to presume that the husband is also the father. And Blackstone was describing the English common law. He says, you know, for domestic peace and tranquility, we just have to assume that the husband is the father unless he be out of the kingdom for 9 months. Like, unless he's sailing on a ship for 9 months, we're going to say this guy's the father, which, you know, it sort of makes sense, right? Domestic peace and tranquility. But then when it comes to transgender men in marriages, you would think, okay, that paternal presumption of, like, if there's someone who's married, if they're married, the other person gets to be presumed to be the father or the parent. That doesn't necessarily, or that hasn't held for transgender men. So there's lots of interesting ways that gets incorporated. And even the tracking the population and keeping track of people, like who's male and who's female. Some people suggest it goes back to the origin of the modern state with, for example, Napoleon, who wanted to keep track of each village, like how many boys were born in that village. And he wanted to know how many boys were born in a village. So he would go back there in, you know, 13, 14, 15 years and grab them up to force them to join the army. So there's always been an interest in kind of tracking the population for these other reasons.
And just to be clear, there have always been trans people among us, correct?
Yeah, we definitely didn't have that language, but there's always been people who don't identify with the sex they're assigned at birth or cross gender norms or live a whole life in another gender. That's been the case for a long time.
So I want to go back to this. You mentioned it briefly earlier. How did the Obergefell v. Hodges ruling by the Supreme Court, the one that established same-sex marriage as a constitutional right, change the purview of the government to grant or deny rights based on sex or gender? Did anything else rise or fall with Obergefell?
Yeah, because Obergefell, it looks like a decision about gay rights, but in some senses, it was also a feminist decision, because the distinction, like saying that, you know, there has to be a distinction between, there has to be one man and one woman in a marriage, kind of resonated with traditional ideas about what a marriage should look like, but it had a huge effect on the transgender rights. And I can give it a specific example, because I was working on the New York City birth certificate policy, you know, as an advocate and as an expert on different committees, you know, for like the last 20 years. And we didn't make much progress. And then in 2011, the governor of the state basically made it, you know, he you know, used his power to get legislation passed that made same-sex marriage legal in the state. And suddenly, in the bureaucrats at, you know, who were deciding on people's sex for birth certificates and resisting our suggestions for change, suddenly they just got totally chilled out. And they were like, this is fine. And in fact, they told us before, when there had been a ban on same-sex marriage, they said, our fear is that a cisgender lesbian will say she's a transgender man and marry another cisgender lesbian, like two women will get married, and they'll say it's an opposite sex marriage by pretending to be transgender.
So that's a really specific fear, by the way.
It's a super specific fear. And another policymaker at the state level said their fear, the New York Daily Post is sort of the right, you know, it's a conservative tabloid. So their fear is that, like, you know, a same-sex marriage would show up on the cover of the New York Post, and that would be made possible by making it too easy for transgender people to change their sex classification on their birth certificate. So when the ban on same-sex marriage was ended in the state in 2011 and nationally in 2015, it really did kind of lower the burden for sex classification. I mean, before that, it was just crazy. So many trans people are married, and most marriages aren't challenged. When they were challenged, didn't turn out well, but most marriages weren't challenged. But when your spouse dies, whether or not you are eligible for survivor benefits from the Social Security Administration was like super complicated, and not even the Social Security Administration could tell you. So there's all these ways in which benefits and marriage are kind of wrapped up in this sex classification system.
Paisley, I also think about, I know in Western culture, I'm not as familiar with other cultures, there's a long history of like art and literature and novels that sort of position trans folks as tricksters, as people who have some kind of agenda, who are trying to pull the wool over the eyes of an unsuspecting person who becomes like their sexual or life partner. Do you see the tide of these stories changing?
Well, I think we definitely in popular culture, like depicting a transgender person as a trickster or as a fraud is much less likely. We're much less likely to see that. I don't know if you remember But I, you know, I used to read tons of, like, you know, detective mystery novels, and so many times, like, oh, they turned on this kind of trick of, like, oh, the person was actually a woman, but they were pretending to be a man. There's this kind of fraud discourse that's going on, and I think that's sort of over in terms of popular, you know, mass media and popular culture. But I also think there's still this cisgender presumption that everybody is cisgender. Like, I just went on a 4-day canoe trip with a bunch of strangers from Meetup, and it was perfectly nice. I just want to be in nature, nice people, paddling, not talking about work. It was great. I had this really nice paddling partner, and then at the end of the trip, I'm driving him back to where his car is parked, and I get a phone call. I think, oh, I better take it in case, you know, I forgot a paddle somewhere. Anyways, it's someone from the press talking about the book, and they're saying, oh, by the way, what pronoun do you use? Do you say you're a transgender man? And so, anyways, the cat was out of the bag, and I was just thinking, oh dear, he didn't really figure that I was transgender, and now it's all kind of happening. But it turned out fine. But he sat there quietly for like five minutes as he was kind of rethinking every assumption he'd made about him, about myself. But it worked out fine.
What do you know about governments elsewhere in the world? Are there any that do not concern themselves with determining individual sex identities or keeping a record of this?
I think most places do classify people's sex at birth, because if you look at passport policies, you know, a lot of countries, including the United States more recently, have allowed there to be non-binary categories on passports. But they do warn you when traveling that, hey, this might be a problem. So every country, you know, because of this international passport system, has this kind of all these sets of identifiers, and your gender is one of them. Whether there are countries that care less about gender in terms of distributing resources, I think that's hopefully and probably true.
Is there a good argument to be made for lobbying all levels of government to just fully eliminate categories of sex or gender identity on official documents?
I think we can make that argument in terms of, like, what's fair and what's just. Like, is there what are the what would be the reason to keep track of people's gender? And there's this group at Harvard, they call themselves the Sex Gender Science Lab I'm associated with. And what they talk about is, like, we need to have understandings of sex that is contextual. So, for example, if you're getting a driver's license, you don't need to have your sex or gender on there. But if you're a medical professional and you want to know the medical history of a person, it makes sense to know that you don't have to know what their official gender is, but to know, like, what kind of body they have and, you know, what kind of needs they have. So it kind of needs to be contextual and based on the actual problem at hand, and not on some kind of grand determination of what your gender is.
So what guidelines would you suggest around the rights of individuals to determine their own identities? Are there ways that we can give people more autonomy in this?
I think we can give people autonomy by letting them choose their gender category and then ultimately getting rid of the gender categories. So, just like many driver's license policies in like 22 states, you can say you're male, you're female, you're non-binary, and then eventually just get rid of them. And then just keep gender as, like, an interesting thing to know about someone. Like, you might want to know about other aspects of their history if you're treating them medically or something like that. But so I do think that's the long-term goal. I fear that we're pretty far away from that right now.
That was our conversation from August with Paisley Kura, professor of political science and women's and gender studies at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, co-editor of Transgender Rights and founding co-editor of Transgender Studies Quarterly. His book is called Sex Is as Sex Does: Governing Transgender Identity. If you enjoyed this episode of Think, listen to our conversation with Gal Beckerman, writer and editor at the New York Times Book Review. He joined us in April to discuss the origins of big ideas, from the scientific revolution to feminism, and the surprising ways social movements spread. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get the podcast at our website, where you can find out about upcoming shows and subscribe to our new newsletter. That is think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.